Berkeley, California on August 8th, 2001. This is tape number 10. Okay, let's try it with higher volume and see if that's better.
Both of us, I guess.
I think you're right. Okay. Well, we had you at MIT, and you were, when we stopped, we had to stop kind of hurriedly last time. You were just beginning to tell about, you had told about a little bit about your wedding and Peggy's uncle. Did you have a best man at your wedding?
Oh yeah, the best man was my roommate, Bud Samuel, who...
Bud Samuel, okay.
Through him, I met Peg and one of the ushers was Jack Jordan, and I'd have to look at a picture to decide who the other was, but it's probably Peg's brother Pete.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that was...
Now, did you have a car in those days?
No. Yes. Peg's brother had graduated, I think, in 1952 from Columbia in Business Administration. He was about to get in the Army, and because that was 1952, and Peg's father bought a car for him so he could tour the U.S. just to spend the 2-3 months that he would have before he had to report for the Army, and this was a 1949 Chevy that I then, when Pete got done with it, I then bought that car from Peg's dad.
Mm-hmm.
And so yes, that was the first car I had. Prior to that, all the cars were my roommate Bud's car. Wherever we went, went with him, or once in a while he loaned it to me, but I had no money. Before.
You didn't need one in Cambridge, of course.
No, especially because your roommate had a car.
Right.
you know, weekends or anything, you know, like trips up into New Hampshire, et cetera, that we had done, you know, in the fall to see the colors and things, he always had the car available. But anyway, I acquired the car at that point.
So you got settled then in Cambridge in an apartment right across from the memorial. Auditorium.
Right, and then started the first term there at MIT.
This was your first time teaching, wasn't it?
Oh yeah, right. And in fact, that fall, if I remember, I just filled in on some of the lectures for a few weeks for Phil DeBrain, who had gone to Holland to get married. I'd mentioned that Overbeek's niece had come with Professor Overbeek to look after their children, and I guess Phil DeBrain started to look after her, and he was gone maybe about a month or so, so my first teaching was really giving whatever lectures that were involved while he was away.
What was that?
It was on flotation behavior of minerals, if I recall. That kind of topic, anyway, in the mineral engineering undergraduate senior course, as I remember. Our first house dinner guest was shortly after we moved in, was Frank Applin, and whom you know well. And Frank, who I had known from South Dakota and Montana, at that time was working maybe at Climax. I know he was for a little while at University of Washington. Maybe that's where he was for about 2-3 years. And he decided, was kind of considering what he might do, and I suggested he come to MIT as a grad student. And so he arrived there in the fall of 1953 to start a doctoral program. And
what was the date of your marriage?
August 29, 1953.
Okay. You have an anniversary coming.
Yeah, number 48.
So Frank came then in the fall of 53.
He was fall of 53, and as I say, an old friend, and I remember Phil DeBrain had a certain research project related to absorption through vapor phase, and I suggested to Frank that that might be a good topic, and so it ended up that Applin actually did his research with under DeBrain, always part of this whole group, and but at that time, I can tell you a little bit about Hay.
Okay, good.
This was, as I say, fall of 1953, and as an assistant professor, I got $4,800 per year.
Good.
Well, not so good. and so $4,800 a year, and that was what MIT called an 11-month basis, so that meant no summer pay. But what really kind of irritated me, and maybe other assistant professors, for postdoctoral researchers got $6,000 per year.
Mm.
I mean, that to me is borders on, you know, I don't understand the reasoning even to this day, that postdocs got 25% more than the assistant professors.
And they were doing just research. No
just
teaching.
Research, and you know, here today a postdoc, you know, is paid a fraction of the, mm-hmm. what, say, an assistant professor gets. But that always sort of rankled me a bit. Maybe they figured, well, faculty people could do some consulting or things like that. Or
were there many postdocs?
There were two or three in our group, or four or five maybe. In other words, this project that, which was then AEC, Atomic Energy Commission, if that's what it was called that early, that Godin had supported, obviously a lot of people, and did for quite a few years. And nothing I'd like to maybe comment
Let
on.
Let me just add, how many assistant professors were there?
Two of us, I'm just speaking in this mineral engineering, maybe myself and Phil DeBrain, and then a year later, another one. So they did run like two or three.
Not many.
But it was many years, I knew that a lot of the academic pay at MIT came out of contracts and grants, and years later, Professor Chipman, after he'd retired, used to spend January, February in our department here working with
here at Berkeley.
Professor Hultgren, and I remember one time talking with him, and he said at that time, or when, you know, this might have been 25, 30 years ago, that at MIT were 15 in metallurgy then, 15 FTE and 33 bodies. In other words, there are 33 faculty people on 15 university slots, so, which means everybody was almost, or less than half of their pay was coming from the university, and more than half was coming from research.
With outside funding.
Outside funding, and I don't know what it's like today, but that's always been characteristic of a lot of places. I know when I was first here, all of the engineering at Stanford were 50% pay on university, 50% projects, and you can see what happens when money gets tight. All of a sudden, you're going to break out in there. Cold sweat, I think, of where's your pay going to come from? Mm. Here at Berkeley, all pays 100% on the university, and for almost all the faculty. I'm not talking about summer, but I think that was a policy that was set long ago, and actually a good one in some sense. But anyway, that was the situation in 1953.
Mm-hmm. I interrupted you. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that. I asked you how many there were, but you were about to say that another thing that you wanted to comment on.
It's hurt my mind now.
Well, I'm sorry. You were talking about, the discrepancy between the assistant professors and the postdocs, but then there was another thing.
I don't know whether that was it or not, but there was also, we had a lab technician, and his pay was, I think, either the 4,800 or the 6,000. I mean, one or the other. I mean, it was. You know, in other words, poor young assistant professor was in a bind. Well, in fact, in those days, you know, $100 went for rent, $100 for food, $100 for the car, $100 for taxes. Yeah. You know, there went $400 per month. Well, of course, Peg's dad paid the tuition. She was a senior now at Radcliffe, so it didn't leave a great deal.
No.
But gasoline, I remember, typically 17 cents or something like that. Or even once, a couple of years later in New Jersey, 13 cents in a gas war compared to today.
A big difference.
So anyway, I had to start with, I think, one person doing a master's thesis with me, and a very good person started. Who had done a master's there with DeBrain, started working with me on his doctor's thesis research, and it really was what I wanted to do was to continue the kind of work that I had done how do surfactants, these organic reagents, absorbent oxide-water interfaces in relation to flotation. But I wanted him to work with a mineral that would change its charge. And you take something like quartz until you get to a very, very low pH, it's always negatively charged. But alumina, corundum, sapphire, just a slightly alkaline pH of about 9 changes from either positive at lower pHs to negative at higher pHs. So we could study the how the charge on the surface would affect all of this. And so I had this person who was named Harsut Modi, M-O-D-I. He had come from India, Bombay, as I remember.
Harsuk,
H-A-R-S-U-K-H. And I think he's only, in fact, I now know he's only a year younger than I am. In fact, 5 years ago, saw him in India, and he's still not retired, and really a pleasant, sharp individual. And by the way, what I still remember, he wrote English about as well as anybody I've ever seen. And I think that resulted, if I remember from talking with him, went to a parochial school or something like that in India, which then, from childhood, apparently studied in English, so that, but his writing was really excellent. All the time I was there, then he was doing his research, and then he finished his doctorate in 3 years, in the third year.
How do you measure these charges?
I won't answer.
Okay. I know that this sort of thing is in the technical literature, but just to give me a sense of how you were measuring these things. Did you design special equipment, or was it already available?
Whoever it was. Mm-hmm. Is it running?
It's
good. Oh, yeah, it's running. Okay. This was the very same equipment that I had used, which is to make a container where you have a bed of the mineral particles at the end of this bed of particles you have two electrodes and then two chambers or flasks that can hold the solution. And if one then with forces a solution through the bed of particles, it strips off the absorbed ion, sets up a potential. And you measure that electrical potential, and from the theory you can back calculate what the electrical potentials would be at the mineral surface. And this phenomenon is called streaming potentials. You can take
It does have to be in solutions.
Usually it's aqueous solution. Mm-hmm. It could be organic solution. But for example, when sap runs up a tree, there's capillary pressure that causes the sap to rise in the tree. There have been people who have actually measured the potentials that exist. You stick two electrodes up the tree, and as the sap goes, it's doing the same phenomenon. It sets up a potential, and people have measured that. And so this, or you can do the reverse, or apply the potential, make the liquid move, and that's used to dry clays. Engineers have used this to stabilize embankments, you know, when they're building a road or something, because it pulls the water out, and now when it gets dry, it won't slide.
Huh.
And then the other one is if you have a very fine particle and you apply a potential, a suspension of, you know, very fine colloidal particles, then the particles will move. If the particle is negatively charged, well, it will move towards a positive electrode, and from the speed at which it moves and so on, you can again back calculate what is happening. So this is what I had done, and then while Modi was working, I all of a sudden got the idea that, going back to the court system, that to change, I did all my work with a 12 carbon amine, 12 methyl groups that make a long chain. You know, as I told you, ethyl alcohol that has two carbons, and propyl alcohol, you know, that people use for around, I think because rubbing alcohol has three carbons, and methyl alcohol, you know, wood alcohol, it's got only one. But this had 12, and I decided that, well, if we vary the number of carbons, I did all this myself, and I did it very quickly because I, for 3 years, had been doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So I changed the, or got these very, very pure chemicals, and I mean extremely pure amines from Armor Chemical Company. You know, Armor Meatpacking was a big producer of amines and soaps and fatty acids, because it comes from the fat from tallow from the beef. And, you know, they manufactured. So I had was able to get amines that were 12, 14, 16, 18, and I think down to 10 carbons. And so what happens when the chain wants to get out of water, as I told you the other day, and so if you make the chain longer, it's going to want to get out of the water even more. So this happens at more dilute solution. And in fact, every added carbon changes this effect by one-third the concentration in solution. So I got these very regular breaks. The longer the chain, the more dilute with these zeta potential breaks, or these the breaks in these zeta potentials.
Zeta.
That's what we calculate out of all of these measurements. And so that was, you know, really very definite proof of this whole idea that these absorbed organic ions are aggregating, like micelles, or we call hemimycelles, you know, at the surface. So I published a paper, Journal of Physical Chemistry, just on that basis rather quickly. I wanted to get, you know, these ideas into the chemical literature. But I had Modi work on the alumina, because there we could work both plus or minus solid. Quartz, as I told you, is always negative, so that's why we only work with the amine. But with the alumina, he could work with an organic anion, like a detergent, which are sulfonates. They got sulfur oxygen groups that make it an anion, and he could also work with the amine on a cation when it's oppositely charged. So that was really the main. I was heavily involved with looking after the research of those people. I can tell you, in those, all my time at MIT, I I almost daily went and talked and discussed and suggested what you do next on all the research of all the people working for me. I mean, I, of course, was young and not tied up with a lot of things, but that I don't, in other words, kind of spoon-feeding the people. And when I came here to Berkeley, I decided that, hey, this isn't really the way to do it, and that people should do much more of it on their own. I mean, you know, we talked about it, we'd have meetings, but I, well, once in a while I spent a lot of time on it with a given person, but I decided that the best way to develop somebody was that they do it individually. See, I did everything myself. I never went to Grodin to say, what should I do next? Where do I get this? How do I do it?
Did he check on you, though?
Well, most of it, I think, our interaction on what I was doing was when a visitor came through and he was touring the lab, and then I would tell the person what I'm doing, and of course we're writing either monthly or quarterly reports, quarterly I think, that went to the AEC.
That's not very often.
Yeah, no, in contrast to what I did daily, which as I say, is not the way I think should be done. It's pretty easy to produce a technician that way. Mm-hmm. You know, to me, it's much better that the person learn to get something done and accomplish it. And I've had people here that just come. In fact, they ask you everything. You know, where do I get this? What do I do? That's not going to create a self-motivated person, I think. Mm-hmm. And I've watched here how different people handle students through the decades. Some, you know, do things, let the student be quite independent, and one of them I can recall was even in his senior years was spoon-feeding more or less. But that, I really was constantly involved then. Also, I had a couple of people that worked on, two or three that worked on projects that were not grad students in our department. In fact, three of them were actually graduate students in geology, but they worked as a research assistant with me. So, I mean, now that we had the funding, you know, with this AEC contract. By the way, I had never had any idea what the total dollar amount of that was. I was not involved in the management of it. Rush Spedden was the first year or so when I was a grad student, and maybe DeBrain became that person. I just never even entered my mind to ask. But I did have two or three people do some research with me, and one of them, I was always interested in doing things related to flotation. But I got interested in what might control the rate of flotation, so I wanted to look at what was the velocity with which air bubbles move. So we built a device and a tank, and I had seen some publications and reports from the Navy that air bubbles move in tap water slower than they move in distilled water. So we decided to look at this rather closely. And there's somebody who then was a physics professor at MIT named Edgerton. You may have seen the name. He's the one that took those super high-speed photographs, and I'm speaking 50 years ago, like a bullet going through an apple. Mm. You may have seen that.
Splattering.
Or a droplet splattering. Mm. You'd see a milk drop, and then you see all the little bubbles, little droplets sprayed out in the ring. So we got borrowed a strobe camera set up from him so that we could take, you know, a series of rapid pictures as these air bubbles would rise. What's interesting, when a bubble is about 1 millimeter in diameter, it rises about at a rate that's about twice as fast as it would if it were a solid. And what happens is the bubble starts to circulate inside, but you add just a little bit of alcohol to the solution, which is what we did. We added a frothing agent, and it's those molecules of the froth are sort of like a sailboat, and they're swept to the bottom of the bubble, and all that slows the bubble down, and it makes the bubble now act like a solid. And I'm speaking of extremely dilute solutions. And I published that in a mining engineering magazine, and yet that was the very first time an explanation and a study was done that to show, you know, what is going on. And you know, if I'd been thinking a little broader, I would have systematically gone through, let's say, a series of alcohol chains, but I didn't. I was just aiming at what does a flotation froth do to the system. But then when you make big bubbles, you know, the bigger, then they start changing their shape, and when you get very big bubbles, they go up like an umbrella. And you've seen that in these water, you know, water bottles, you know, that when somebody's got spring water, you know, big tank. You ever watch the bubbles when they go up? The big ones, next time look at it, you'll see the big ones go up like an umbrella. It's all due to, you know, the forces that are acting and change the shape. And the little ones will be round, so we had got a very nice piece of work out of that, but I never...
But you say you never pursued it?
I never, just the one, never continued it, a nice, very good publication came out of it, but here was an interesting phenomenon that I should have pursued. Other people have done it
you can't do
since.
It
yeah, you're right. So then after the next year...
Let me just ask, what sort of reaction do these papers get then? Do you... were you aware that these were important papers? Did people get in touch with you?
You know, in the old days, before the Xerox machine, etc., you know, people always wrote and asked for reprints. Mm-hmm. Once in a while, you know, people still do, but so one, you could tell from the kind of you know, who's written and asked for copies of the paper. Well, some of this, you know, a lot of my publication got into AIME publications, and of course they're picked up by the slipping my mind, you know, the
transactions.
Well, where you I'm getting old. Anyway, though he's referencing volumes that tell you what all the publications are. American Chemical Society has always has had a big one. I can't, the word's slipping my mind. Anyway, these AIME are picked up there, and a lot of journals are. Sometimes some of those professional journals may not be indexed this way, and so on. But of course, in more recent years, there's this thing called citation index. As you well know, people sit down and have tabulated how many times this author in this paper is cited by other people. You know, you can go to, I know it's in the physics library, they have these by the first time I heard about that, I thought that was a little odd, but some agencies use that as their Bible, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, it
gives you a way of knowing how important your paper has been.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And of course, in the field, the people working in the field would be reading them. These two things I've talked about were research that is more, you know, more broad, and
it must have caused quite a little excitement.
Oh yeah, yeah, right, right, but like I said, I always had this. Was aiming at how to explain flotation phenomena. Then in the fall of 54 came, I suppose each year there were 2, 3, 4 new grad students, but two very good people who did very well through the next decades arrived, and one whose name I think I may have mentioned already, George Parks, who it was, you know, before I was here, had done his BSMS here at Berkeley and had come to MIT to do a doctorate. And at that time, Professor Ravitz here had urged him, he'd done his master's with Ravitz and said, he came from Berkeley and he said, the city of Berkeley, and he said, you really should go elsewhere, you know, so he came, you know, to MIT and worked he did his thesis with Debrain also. And then another very good person arrived at the same time named Iwasaki. Iwasaki was did his BS, he's Japanese, did his BS and MS at the University of Minnesota, and he told me that some family had a son that had come home in Minneapolis, come back on a plane or something, and got killed in a taxi, and they took the insurance and set up a scholarship program to bring somebody from Japan to the U.S. Mm. And so he came as a junior from Japan to University of Minnesota and was an undergraduate and then master's there. And then he came to MIT in that same fall. And his name was, he's still to this day, is Pete. And a little funny little story. He said when he came through immigration, the immigration officer, American, said, your name's Iwao. Iwao means rock. It's so I'm going to call you Pete.
Oh, pretty learned.
And Pete stuck. I mean, well, so he's always been Pete Iwasaki. And, well, and that's how that happened. And by the way, he was another person whose writing of English was always excellent. You know, he and Modi were there, you know, at the same time. And Pete Iwasaki's English was very, very good.
I think sometimes this happens that people who learn English overseas more academically do learn it very well.
Yeah, well, as you probably well know, the problem with most of them is articles. They know, they leave them out and then you start putting them in, and then it turns out they start putting them in. They know they got to go there, so they're a little bit random, right?
Sometimes.
but both of them did, Modi and Iwasaki were superb. Iwasaki later, his whole career, most of it, was at the University of Minnesota, and he became extremely well known for a lot of things on iron ore flotation, this kind of thing. He went back to Minnesota on the faculty and actually returned twice or thrice to Japan, but he had become too much of an American. He went back, worked for Fuji Iron and Steel, and believe it or not, I think it was research for Fuji. I think it was Fuji, they said, "Well, you really need a Japanese doctorate." And you know, he, I think, wrote a thesis that gave him also a Japanese doctor's degree. That was more important to the Japanese than his MIT doctorate.
Uh-huh.
He was there a few years, then came back again, joined the faculty at Minnesota. Mm-hmm. There a long time, and then at a well-known Japanese professor, Wada, retired from Tohoku University, and he was invited back to be the professor. He was there 1 month, and the Japanese students paraded through his office protesting nuclear subs in Okinawa, I think, mm-hmm. something to that effect. And he said he got on a telephone, called the people up in Minnesota again and said, "Hey, can I come back? Is my position still there?" And he returned again to the U.S.
Yeah.
And then when he retired, roughly retired, now he's my age, when he roughly retired, he went back to Japan, worked 5 years, I saw him in Japan on a trip for Mitsubishi. Then when he hit 70, they retired him, and he's come back again to the University of Minnesota, but up in Duluth, where they have an iron ore research. And his family, he did get married in Japan, and his wife and three children were in Minneapolis for quite a while, but they didn't like that. They went back to Japan. So he, all these years, every little while, makes a trip back to Japan. Right, he's a great, outstanding person, you know, and on iron ore flotation, for example.
What university did you say, Professor Wada?
Tohoku. Tohoku. I think it's T-O-H-O-K-U, mm-hmm. Tohoku.
Okay.
And it's one of the three, you know, major mm-hmm. Japanese universities. But anyway, Pete started his graduate work there, and then that fall, I think Godin wanted me to develop a course on ion exchange methods and ion exchange phenomena, because ion exchange resins are used to extract uranium from leak solutions. So I developed a course, and I taught at least once, maybe twice. I never did any of that here. It was a area that never really fascinated me. And so I never pursued that. Well, actually, now I let me back up to the spring of 54. Now, I was on the faculty, and I remember going to a faculty meeting where the faculty then voted on the award of the doctor's degrees for the coming commencement. And so I voted on my own degree.
Oh.
However, my diploma says, doctorate August something, 1953. But I attended the commencement in 54, and MIT had a little enticement that if you attend commencement in person, they give you the hood for free.
Uh-huh.
So I went to the participating in commencement, and at that time, Dick Charles, who I mentioned earlier, he also got his doctorate. And then he became an assistant professor also. And so that would be the summer of 54, June 54. And at MIT, they made the faculty every other year had to attend commencement.
Mm-hmm.
Here, some of the faculty attend commencement, most don't, I think. And a place like South Dakota School of Mines, they naturally all attend commencement, mm-hmm. And are expected to. Attended commencement then. Of course, Peg graduated from Radcliffe that spring, and so that was a great occasion. Mm-hmm. And her mother had died sometime during a few months earlier than that, so her father was there. And her mother had gotten a disease called scleroderma, and that's something that's one of those debilitating ones. I think at most you live 7 years, and Peg said that her mother apparently always got sunburned when she was younger.
Mm-hmm.
And this thing called scleroderma, she had gotten some while earlier, and so I was only in the early 50s,
mm-hmm.
at that age stage, and so, but anyway, her father was there.
Mm-hmm.
We had decided, Peg and I, that, well, why didn't she? I looked at this just as an insurance thing, go to school again, and I imagine, I don't know whether, I have a feeling I paid the tuition. She decided to go to Simmons, Simmons College, mm-hmm. and got a master's degree in library science. Mm-hmm. So that year of 54, 55, then she was a grad student in library science. There wasn't much science to it, but she got a master's then. And we thought, well, that'd be a fallback if that was ever needed for working.
Let me ask a very personal question, because at that, was contraception still banned in Massachusetts at that time? Do you recall?
So many things were banned in Massachusetts. That's probably true.
You were obviously delaying your family for reasons.
Oh yeah, for several years.
And it was at that.
When we.
It might have been difficult in Massachusetts.
It probably was.
New York or something?
I just you know, Massachusetts had so many negative laws. They were called blue laws, you know, and on Sunday the bars had to take the stools off the bar stool. There was stand, if you wanted to go in and get a beer on a Sunday, which I didn't do very often. But
were
I
mean, they even open?
Well, they were open, but the bar stool was off. You could only sit in the booth. Oh. So here'd be the stand sticking up like a post and no bar stool. So Massachusetts really was, I suppose it's all due to the Irish Catholic domination of the city. And I have no idea when they things like the pill didn't come in until we were long gone, and
I think contraceptives were not available for sale.
Maybe not, I guess.
I don't know, because this is a few years after I was there, but I know that
would have been the most rigorous enforcement of any state, I think, in the country.
Connecticut, too.
Well, probably not as bad as Mass.
Maybe not.
Our first offspring wasn't born until 57.
We were both pretty involved.
So then, that fall of, by the way, the fall of 54, remember, MIT did a lot of recruiting, and I spent 1 week, I suppose they probably had the younger faculty people. I was sent for a week, and this was a Monday through Friday, visiting three prep schools or high schools in around Philadelphia suburbs for a whole week. I remember there's a Germantown Academy and Haverford Academy. I think there's a Haverford Unit College that's quite well known there. And give the spiel about MIT to a whole room full of
boys.
And they're probably girls there too. And a lot of those prep schools were just boys' schools, weren't they?
And MIT.
And the general high school would, of course, be both. But
did MIT have any women in at that time?
You know, there must have been, but I just had no recollection of. There were no women in any class I ever had.
Mm-hmm. I don't think there were.
I don't either. So anyway, I spent this whole, this week, it was a hard week, I had a car, rented a car and drove from, plus find them, because this was all the, sort of that northwest suburb of Philadelphia, and get there in time, and maybe 2 a.m, 1 p.m, or 1 a.m, 2, I forget what, but that was, 15 places I visited, they at that time did this, I think, around the country in all the major cities. I don't know if they do that kind of recruiting today. I doubt it.
You mentioned renting a car. South Dakota residents couldn't rent cars at that time. Were you a Massachusetts resident then?
Hey, I told you how driving back as a grad student, I had no South Dakota license, and it was incredulous to the highway patrolman in Mass, so I need to say, I then had a driver's license.
You got one in Massachusetts.
Oh, I had to. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And did.
Passed the test.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I remember you asking about a postdoc. I remember there was a Egyptian postdoc who was probably 35-ish then, Mohammed Hafawi, and he just drove a car like he was driving a camel, I guess. He came back and told, about three times how he flunked the test. It was obviously a good thing he flunked, right? For a driver like that. So there are those out there. Mm-hmm. I know a couple different times another assistant professor and his wife and us, maybe the four of us, hosted some kind of evening dinner, at MIT in the lab or something. Things were set up to, departmental, let's say, but certain people assigned to to do these tasks.
So and this was a social
evening? Well, social evening, period. But I must have been assigned by the department head to you and this other person do that. And by the way, when we lived on that first fall on 1734 Cambridge Street, a block away in a big apartment building was the administrative assistant of the metallurgy department. And she must have been a woman then, about 50, and I was 24. And anyway, she handed out the parking stickers, and I went to her to get a parking sticker. Of course, she knew where I lived, which is a block from where she lived. What she said, "I take the bus, you take the bus."
Oh.
End of my request for a parking sticker.
Mm.
It shows you who had the power, right?
Right.
I have never forgotten that.
Mm.
And then...
actually, you were within walking distance, weren't you?
Oh, no, it was a mile. Oh, sure. But, yeah. Oh, sure. Mile and a half, maybe, or a mile and a quarter. But then it turned out another grad student who had worked for this Watertown Arsenal project that Godin had on uranium, named Will Freiberger. And Freiberger, whose wife had also worked there, they lived in Medford or Melrose, one of those towns or suburbs. And he had a parking sticker, and he got two of them. They sent him two by mistake.
Mm-hmm.
So he gave me one of them, and that was my parking sticker, but the ad assistant wouldn't give it to me. Terrible, right? So that's how I was able to park.
How did Peggy get to Simmons?
She took the bus, I guess.
Uh-huh. And to Radcliffe first, she would...
Well, Radcliffe, we were right in the very edge of the Harvard campus, was just steps, some of the lecture halls, mm-hmm. half a block, one block. Radcliffe, the dorms are about six blocks maybe up. Of course, you can go by streetcar, but that was an easy walk. But there were, Radcliffe Library and two, three other Radcliffe buildings that you may have visited someplace mm-hmm. near Harvard Square. And, but no classes were there. I think it was just study library and maybe Radcliffe offices, but all classes were were Harvard lectures, so she, and I'm sure she probably took the streetcar or bus over to Simmons. You know, and I've never ever been at Simmons campus. I have no idea. Hey, I may have gone over there when she may have attended commencement. I just don't recall.
Life was pretty hectic,
I imagine. Right.
You mentioned entertaining. What sort of social life were you having with all of this? Did you have parties?
A few of the... Yeah, you know, with some of the other assistant professors, we had got together for dinner, and there were, I remember, Halloween party at one of them, and that sort of thing, and bridge playing was much more dominant. You know, people don't play bridge here very much.
No.
Whereas around Boston in the wintertime, you know, so we, a lot of it, you know, was playing bridge, but also dinner. And then the first year, of course, two of Peg's best friends were also, had gotten married, and so we would have, be at their place for dinner or vice
versa. What did you eat?
I'll tell you one thing we ate. We went to one of them, Ronnie Strauss, Schwab was now the name, and it was tuna fish casserole. The next day at home, Peg served tuna fish casserole, and I said, never again will there ever be tuna fish casserole in our house. And then there'd never, ever been tuna fish casserole. And so I think that was probably, a guest type of meal for student guests, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, funny.
It's just before pizza.
Oh, yeah, pizza.
What about drinking?
You know, about none. We didn't, boy, I remember, you know, it may have even been when we were in Buffalo, it was the first time we ever bought a bottle of wine, and the woman said, Peg said, the woman in the liquor store said, well, what about a bottle of hot Sauternes? Yeah. I mean, that was how she pronounced it.
Mm-hmm.
And, no, I do remember with Will Freiberger going playing golf one day, or I did with him a few times, and he came back, his wife, you know, mixed some red wine with soda water, very dilute, which is a very nice drink.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe, we played bridge with the Freibergers quite a bit, and might have had a little bourbon or something. I don't think I ever owned any bourbon or beer. And 1734 Cambridge Street tried making let the cider ferment, and I set it up. I think Russ Spedden was telling how to ferment cider, and I set up all the apparatus in the bathtub and let it gurgle away, and we came home one late afternoon, and the whole thing had blown up, exploded on the ceiling.
Oh, dear.
Never tried that one again. No, that was virtually none.
Would have mentioned dropping in for a beer.
Must have a bit, but I used to go out and drink beer with Jack Jordan and so on, when I was a grad student, but I just...
It was not
minor.
A part of
it. Oh, it was just not... didn't enter my, just wasn't part of our existence then, no. I guess, much.
Did the professors entertain you? Did they invite you to your house, to their house?
Yeah, we were several times at Professor Godin's house. He lived out in Newtonville, if you know where Newton, Newtonville was, and he once or twice a year seemed to have, maybe at least once a year, all of the grad students and group out, and right even from when I was a student. And then often when there'd be visitors, he might have them to dinner, and I remember more than one time, you know, picking the visitor up and then driving out to Godin's home. And now I'm saying with the younger ones, there were about three or four of us that seemed to get together every little while. But I remember one very elegant home, gee, full of Greek statues and so on, John Norton. I think he probably married well. But he lived right near Harvard campus in a beautiful old house, but I just vaguely remember a lot of either Greek or Roman statues that they collected. And